This is Season 2, Episode 21 of the Language Mastery Show with Chris Broholm. Here's a little sample of what's coming up.
The Broholm coefficient is that the best method for you to use is the one that is the most fun and the most efficient. So it's like, right, if you imagine like graph, there'll be methods that are extremely boring but very efficient, mm-hmm, and there'll be methods that are extremely fun but very inefficient.
Welcome back to the Language Mastery Show. This is your host, John Fotheringham. Today's episode, I welcome back Chris Broholm. He was on the show in 2015 and comes back again now to talk about some of the lessons he's learned in the meantime, some of the patterns that he's observed now after interviewing lots and lots of polyglots, both on his podcast and also at various language events around the world. This is a two-part episode, so stay tuned next week for the conclusion. For show notes and links to all the resources that we mention, go to languagemastery.com/show. And for anyone who happens to be subscribed to both of our podcasts, this will be the same interview on both, so no need to listen twice. All right, here now is part one of my chat with Chris Broholm.
I wanted to dive into what patterns and, you know, sort of little pearls of wisdom you've picked up along the way interviewing, what, 160 now, I think, you know, polyglots, language experts, et cetera, and then if there's anything you've changed your mind about, you know, like when you first started, mm-hmm, you probably had some ideas about kind of the best way to go about language learning. I'm wondering if things have changed for you over the
right
that time period. So what, your first one was like, what, 2014, I think, when you kicked off?
Yeah. Right. That's true.
It's been like 5 years. Yeah. So like what's changed for you? Cause I know for me, I mean, when I first started in 2009 versus now, I've changed a lot of things. I mean, my beliefs and my kind of what I think works and what doesn't. And also realizing like how much it differs person to person. That's changed a lot.
That's cool. Well, maybe we should start with the backstories then, just a little.
Yeah. Cause not everyone. Yeah, we also can't assume that everyone's listened to every episode and knows everything about us.
No, that would be very impressive.
That would be impressive.
That would be very impressive.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's go all the way back to the very, very beginning. In the beginning, there was darkness, and then then there was light, and there was Chris Broholm.
Some podcast came along. Yeah.
Yes.
Well, I'll go first then.
Okay.
I started the podcast in 2014. In March, I think it was just before my birthday. And basically, I was going to the polyglot gathering in Berlin, the first one. Yeah, the first one. And that was in, I think it was in April or maybe June. It was just around the corner. And I'd kind of learned about the polyglot community. I'd been reading a lot and watching all the videos and getting to know some of the people, like the you know, the OGs, like Benny and Richard and Luca, Susanna, you know, some of these who've been around making language learning related content for so long. And I thought
so long in internet years, which is 10 years, which is like 100 years in internet years. Yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah, definitely. There's a context there that, you know, since YouTube came out, basically, right, that's when the language community, I guess, kind of grew, because suddenly you had a new medium that was very suited for it. But and I was just like, wow, what a great lifestyle. I mean, like, can you imagine traveling the world and speaking all kinds of languages and, you know, working from your laptop? And I figured, you know, I didn't really at the time know what I was going to do as a career anyway. And I thought, even if you are a terrible language learner, you know, the languages will always open doors. You know, you can be an interpreter, you can be a translator, you can be, you know, you can get jobs abroad, you can do anything with languages, I feel like. So I thought, okay, if I'm going to specialize in some kind of hobby or do something meaningful, then languages seem like a really good bet. And I think there are a few categories like this that you can kind of go for, but I just decided that languages made sense. I'd been fortunate to grow up with a few languages and start foreign languages quite early in my country. So I just decided to go for it. And the only way I could kind of keep going with Actual Fluency, which was a blog, was to kind of have someone to be accountable to. And that would be, right, initial audience. And just blogging is okay. I think it's not as personal. You don't feel the connection.
Yeah, but not inside someone's head like you are in a podcast.
And I think at the time, I mean, I might be overstating it, but back then I just found podcasting and it was kind of up and coming. Mm-hmm. Like today it's mega. Like podcasting is huge. It's insane. If you don't have a podcast, you know, you're not even in Hollywood, right? Everyone in the showbiz has a podcast of some sort. But back then it was actually quite kind of niche. And
most people still didn't. If you said, I have a podcast, they'd be like, what is a podcast?
You know. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, they were like, oh, it's got something to do with the iPod, which was still available.
Right.
So back then, it was a little bit unusual. Today, it's kind of totally normal. And if I started a podcast, people are like, oh, yeah, you're starting a podcast too. you know, and all the software is available.
My cat has a podcast. Yeah.
Exactly. You know, everyone has a podcast. And that's not to say that's not a bad thing. I would say it shows how much the medium has grown and how part of a life it has become. Right. You know, I was really excited when they announced that they were going to put the podcasting app in cars.
Right.
Like in, you know, the screens you have on the on the dashboard. I heard that they were developing some kind of integration. I can't remember who it was. It was Stitch. And I was like, you know, this is the real mainstream of podcasting because so many Americans especially commute in their car every day.
Oh, yeah.
So that's the perfect medium for that. It happens around the world, of course, but I just know for the U.S. kind of notorious for these ridiculously long commutes.
Especially L.A.
Most of the big cities, I imagine. You just have a different relationship with distance over there. You know, what's far away for a European is like, you know, around the corner for an American.
right.
But that's why I decided to start it. And also, frankly, at the time, I thought there was some kind of secret to language learning because I didn't really know any polyglots personally. I knew a few people who spoke a couple of languages because their parents had a different language they had it from school. But that was only like one language maybe. So I was kind of sure that these people must have found some kind of secret, you know, or they had some kind of ninja tricks, which is very apropos, I guess, from your perspective as well.
Right.
Learning the languages.
Yeah. And I think there's this idea that they are unique outlier geniuses, and that's why they're able to learn so many languages. And I think this might be a good tangent to kind of dive into this part of it maybe, but I think that if you tell somebody you speak 5 languages or 10 languages or, you know, anything more than 1 or 2, especially here in the States, I think people, the first thing you hear is, oh, you must be really smart, you must be really, you know, some kind of crazy genius, you know. And I think I assume we're a spy. Right. But yeah, definitely. I know from the folks I've talked to, it's like, no, I mean, yes, there are those out there. Like, was it Daniel Tammet who learned enough Icelandic in like 7 days to have a media interview, but that's the exception to the rule. It seems like.
Oh yeah, for sure. I think the language learners or the polyglots who learn that many languages, they just spend the first kind of secret, I guess, if you want to call it that, is that they just spend a lot of time on it. And that's basically how everything is mastered. Like if you look at the people who are, you know, ripped and can lift a Toyota in bench pressing, that they probably spend a lot of time in the gym. And and the language people are exactly the same.
Right.
But I wanted to figure out the secret. And that's why I kind of started the podcast, because it gave me an excuse to reach out to these successful language learners and go like, hey, want to talk about language learning? And I kind of, you know, tried to get it out of them, but I never really found the secret.
So no. Was that freeing to you, or was that disappointing, or maybe a bit of both?
That's a very good question, actually. You should do podcasting. Oh, wait. I would say, both, because I think it's freeing in the sense that you don't need anything special to do it.
Right.
Like the process is very logical and it's very repeatable. But in the other sense, it was also a shame because it put a lot of the work back in my mind.
Right.
You know, if there was some kind of secret method, then maybe we could all learn languages, you know, 10 times faster, or we could learn a language in the summer or something. Mm-hmm. But if it just, and I say this just lightly, but if it comes down to having the right mindset and putting the work in, then suddenly it's no different than learning the guitar, losing weight, or so. In that sense, it was a bit disappointing that there wasn't kind of any big standout. I think there's a lot of optimization you can do.
Sure.
And if you haven't listened to an episode of either of our podcasts, you will definitely pick up a lot of tips that can make it easier for you. But at the end of the day, it's just like, you just got to put in the work, you know?
Right.
And
that
was disappointing in some ways, but also freeing because, it meant that I didn't have to search for that anymore. And it was as much as you make it, really.
Right.
Like, you can decide how successful you want to be in languages.
Yeah, it's kind of like you start off, I think we maybe both had this experience, where you start off the journey kind of looking for the holy grail. And then as you go along, you realize, like, you know, there is no holy grail, but that journey to look for it does still have value in that you figure out along the way, just as you said, that it is just showing up. It is just the time. But that,
exactly.
Yeah, there are these little optimizations, as you say, on the side. It might make you, I don't know, 20% more efficient or 30% more efficient, but you can't optimize something you're not doing.
Yeah, exactly. Right. That's it. I would say it's much, much better to do something terribly than this and not doing it at all, because you're worried about not doing it 100% efficiently.
Right.
And the enjoyment is a big success factor. I think that might have been something I learned along the way, is that, first of all, the end result is not the point. Let's say you want to pass a language exam just to give it an end result. Let's say you want to pass the C1 exam. Mm-hmm. Well, for me, and what I realized is that the language learning journey is, gives you the enjoyment all the way from nothing to that point. Passing the exam is sort of just the cream on top, mm-hmm. as it were. And if you don't enjoy the process, then it's very difficult to get any results. But again, that goes for most hobbies and things. So it's not exactly a secret, but
right.
I think enjoying the process and doing something that you enjoy and realizing that learning a language is a journey, and that journey has a lot of ups and downs, a lot of ups, I would say.
Yes.
It is a big change of mindset, because otherwise you just think of a language as, oh, now I don't know it, and now I know it.
Right.
You know,
right. It's not binary.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think that helps a lot, and I've seen a lot of examples of this, and I've had some experiences myself that prove this theory, where I used very basic knowledge of a language to really have a very unique and interesting experience. And I've had a lot of stories of that on the podcast as well. And I think what I try to recommend to people and say, sometimes you have community languages, in the US and the UK, it's English most of the country, but there are pockets of immigrant communities typically. So
right.
You will know if you walk down your local your normal streets, like, what kind of restaurants are there? Are they, is it Chinese restaurants? Is it Romanian? What is it? And if you learn just the words for hello, how are you, in one of those shops or restaurants, you will see, like, just pure, joy from the recipients, usually.
Yeah, the bar is so low.
Exactly.
Have you seen, speaking of that, have you seen that map of the U.S. where it shows the most popular languages per state after Spanish?
Yeah, the U.S. is great.
It's really surprising, because it'll be like states like in the Midwest, for example, where it's like, oh, Vietnamese or, Tagalog, or like these languages that you wouldn't expect to be in that part of the country. But that means, like, there's a lot of native speakers there, or at least people that speak that language.
Yeah, the U.S. is amazing for the aspiring polyglot, because it's so diverse. Like, you obviously you have places that aren't as diverse, but if you go to somewhere like Denmark, just as an example, my home country, 6 million people, so it's tiny. There are, I guess most states probably have more people in them, but I think the languages are something like 99% Danish by population. So yeah, you'll find other languages, but it's not as common, and there aren't that many different ones either.
Right.
So
yeah, what are the languages that you grew up speaking, to go back to kind of the beginning of this conversation? You said there's
yes.
Yeah.
It was in school, yeah. So English is one of them. That's a big one in Denmark. You know, most people learn English to a high enough level to use the language, live in the language. And then I had German as well. It started in fifth or sixth grade. And I went to Germany quite a few times with the school on trips and things like that. So it wasn't really the most exotic languages I was learning. And I definitely was not learning the languages because I was hearing them around me either. And that also made my skills in the languages quite a lot worse. If I could go back and change anything, I would probably, or if I had discovered like this hobby mm-hmm. earlier, you know, I was about 27, 28 at that time when I discovered the hobby. And by then you already kind of set in your ways many, many times. But
right.
when I look back at my time in school, you know, I lived in a smallish city, about 40,000 people. And there were other languages there. Like there were a few Turkish places, like a few Turkish restaurants. I was in an Italian restaurant. So it was there, but for some reason, I don't know. It just never really struck me to spend some time learning it. I was like, I didn't even consider it. And I suspect that a lot of people feel that way because the main language of the country is different. So if you're in the US, well, you would just speak English, right? You don't even have to think about speaking Turkish with the guy in the Turkish restaurant,
right?
Unless you get that inspiration from somewhere. I wish I would have done that. And I mean, that could have been some really nice encounters, and you would have some fixed places to go and practice, actually. And I don't think mind, you know, they're usually quite hospitable. So.
And you have the motivation of getting food if you were.
there you go.
Yeah, instant reward for using the proper words and structures. You know, it made me think what you're saying about how you didn't even think about that as an option. And I think for a lot of people, it's because they think language is something that you learn in a school, and it has to be highly structured. You have to be you know, consciously studying this thing. And I'm inferring from what you're saying about how you'd probably do things differently. If you knew what you knew now, then you'd probably, you know, maybe even go about learning German or English differently. So if you did have a time machine, take us back and what would that language learning journey look like if you were to go about learning new languages now, knowing what you know now?
That's a good question. I think the English and German is hard to change because I was very young. So I started English in fourth grade, but I'd already become quite fluent by then because of video games and that kind of stuff. So
that actually in a respect that you were doing it quote unquote in the right way, probably by what you would say now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. That was a total immersion and out of necessity for getting something done, like, you know, defeating a video game or communicating with other players across the world. That came a little bit later, but I think with German, my biggest flaw was just not using it very much. I didn't have any. We only had the classes with, you know, 19 other Danish people who didn't speak German very well.
Right.
So it was only when I went to Germany on school trips, which happened about, I think I had about three of them over an 8-year period. So it's not like I got a lot of practice in. So if I could go back and change anything about my German, it would be finding a exchange partner or a tutor or something that I could actually speak maybe just an hour a week, you know, because the vocabulary is there when you're in school. That's the one thing that school does. It teaches you about grammar and vocabulary. It's not very good for stringing together sentences, but, you know, if you could do that, then I think you'd be better. But I think the most important thing I would do if I had that time machine is to try and learn something of the other languages. You know, I think also what you mentioned, that some people are hesitant to learn languages. One of the reasons is they think they have to become fluent or not even start learning it.
Right. That there's no value until you're absolutely fully fluent.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The way they see it is like, okay, I'll never be fluent because I don't have the time or commitment to study for that long. And I don't even know how. And language school is expensive and blah, blah, blah.
And I'm not good at languages and exactly. Like 20 myths wrapped into that.
There's a lot of things going on. So they don't even get started because they don't see the value of dabbling in languages, which I think has tremendous value. And I wish I would have dabbled in things like, you know, Turkish and Arabic, which were the most spoken languages in Denmark outside of Danish. And, you know, that could have been that could have been life-changing in a way.
It's not too late, Chris.
I probably will get back to that at some point.
Yeah.
I mean, depending on where I'm going to live. You know, now I live in the UK.
Right.
There are a lot of languages here. So here I have a different problem with just picking one, I suppose. Yeah, in the UK, there are really a lot of different languages spoken, especially if you go to London. I mean, that's ridiculous how many native languages you can hear on the tube every day. But how about you? Did you have any kind of heritage languages around you when you were growing up? What city or a town was a big town you grew up in?
From 0 to 8, I lived in sort of the suburbs of Los Angeles. Spanish, I'm sure, was everywhere, but that languages weren't really on my radar yet. We moved up to Washington State, kind of the suburbs of Seattle, when I was 8. And then that was kind of a linguistic desert, in many ways. But, I actually had the chance to go to Brazil when I was 12 for a 2-week exchange. My dad and a business associate of his, they sort of set up our own little personalized exchange program where I went down there for 2 weeks, and then their oldest son came back with me and then stayed with us for 2 weeks. So that was the first time I'd actually been exposed to foreign languages. And I remember still to this day, we had a really tight connection. So I was 12, so I was unaccompanied minor. And so a flight attendant had to basically accompany me, you know, through the trip, through the airport. So we had a really tight connection in Rio de Janeiro. And this attractive flight attendant grabbed my arm and was literally like pulling me down the jetway trying to get to the next plane. And she was kind of yelling / complaining in Portuguese. And I remember I looked up at her and I said, "I'm sorry, I don't speak Portuguese." And she looked down at me and went, "Yeah, obviously." And I remember like, "Ah, never again. I'm never going to, you know, have that experience again." So that's kind of stuck with me. So that was kind of my first exposure to it. And I just remember thinking there's this whole other world. And the only way to unlock it is with that language. And I didn't actually end up learning Portuguese, at least not yet. But that experience sort of lit the fire for me, definitely. But the first language I really dug into was, I studied French in high school, sort of. I mean, I put air quotes around study. It wasn't really, definitely would not be the way I would learn it now, but it was Japanese. That was really the first one that I sort of bit my teeth into, and definitely would do things differently with that as well. I mean, there's so much I've learned since then. That was the late 90s. I mean, one of the things, obviously, between then and now, I mean, the access to media, I think, is the biggest thing. Online media.
Yeah. It's a lot easier.
You literally can, I always say this to people, you can literally create Japan for yourself anywhere in the world.
Yeah.
Maybe literally is the wrong word, but not, well, but pretty close. I mean, you can, from morning, you know, from when you open your eyes in the morning to when you put your head in the pillow at night, if you go about it, I think, in the right way, you can create a pretty darn good immersion environment for yourself now.
Yeah.
But that would have been much harder to do even 5 years ago, but definitely 20 years ago when I kind of started in that journey. I mean, I used to carry around this 20-pound kanji dictionary. I mean, it was this thing was, it looked like a Gutenberg Bible. I mean, it was like, it was this giant, giant thing. And the only way to look up, I don't know how familiar you are with kanji characters, but you had to look it up by radical. You had to know the number of strokes of the radical and look for that. I mean, it took you 15 minutes to find one particular character. Now, you know, you can just draw it on your phone and find it in like 2 seconds. It's amazing.
Yeah, it really has gotten easier in many ways. I mean, I think that also creates some challenges that definitely was not there before. I'm very concerned about the effects of something like social media, phones, the smartphones have on our ability to concentrate and focus.
Definitely.
Which is a big part of language learning.
That's a good point.
Yeah. So it's like you get a lot of new opportunities, but the more powerful the technology, the more you really have to be careful, I think.
Right. It's Pandora's box.
It really is, yeah, because you're right in that how amazing is it, you know, that we get so many resources, apps and courses and I also like the other side of it, of people, let's say, talking about Japanese, let's say some guy was like, okay, I want to share my native language with the world. I start a blog about learning Japanese and I eventually make a course or a book. You know, they basically build their own job. Like, how cool is that? Right. And in return, someone like you or another Japanese learner get to learn the language of a faraway country over online from their home in Vermont or whatever.
Right.
I think it's wonderful, but it definitely, there's also a quality problem. You know, if you only have one book to study with or whatever, but there's so many apps now. It's so easy to create apps. And I think definitely we see that quality is getting scarcer and scarcer. So you have to be kind of wary of what you do. And
yeah, be a discerning consumer.
Oh yeah. More than ever, I think.
Yeah. And I think another challenge is then sort of this paradox of choice, which I mentioned earlier, problem is greater than ever. It's, there are so many options that a lot of people, I think, waste a lot of time, especially if they have perfectionistic tendencies like me. They spend a lot of time trying to find the quote unquote perfect, you know, resource or.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. No, that's almost an addiction for some people.
Yes.
I did that. I still do that too sometimes. Information overload is very real.
Yes.
Because if you have 200 different Japanese books you could be studying,
right,
it's much more fun to research which book to study than it is to actually just get the first you see and just open it and then right, figure out later if it's the right or the wrong choice.
That's right.
I actually have one of the first messages in my email sequence when people sign up on Actual Fluency. I send like some advice. And one of the advice is like, stop researching and start doing.
Exactly.
Because yeah, it really is, you know, again, going back to, you can learn with a terrible method. And you can learn with a really slow method.
That's right.
You can learn with, you know, you can basically learn any way you want. But
right,
you can't learn if you don't do anything.
That's right.
You know, it's just, if you're just thinking about doing it.
Right.
But that's also, there's a lot to be said about being, let's say, being a polyglot, right? That it has an appeal. A bit like being a millionaire or being an entrepreneur has these days. It sounds nice, but very few people are willing to do what it actually takes to get there.
Right.
It's like exercise as well. You know, getting, let's say you want to become 5% body fat. You know, it sounds nice on paper, but I mean, the work required is just insane.
Right.
So not a lot of people do it.
Right.
And I'm not sure exactly how to solve that. You know, Benny's theory is that Benny Lewis, the guy who kind of inspired me to get into all of this, his theory when I asked him about it, how can we motivate the people who are not really motivated? And he said, well, you don't. You
know, right.
It's not.
Yeah, you can't create motivation for somebody.
That's it. It's not for everyone.
Yeah.
You really have to make sure that you want to do it. And if you don't, then it's almost impossible to get meaningful results.
Right. Yeah, you need a powerful why. That's what I always talk about with people, is that thinking it would be nice or thinking it would be cool to speak another language is not probably going to be enough of a motivator when it does get to the grind. I mean, yes, yeah. I think language learning should be fun most of the time, and there are a lot of ways to make it a lot more enjoyable, at least than, you know, the traditional rote memory and textbook approach. I mean, yeah, that's pretty boring for most people. There are definitely better, more fun ways to do it. But even that, even if you're watching anime or Netflix videos, like, there still is an element of work and effort that is required. Definitely. It's,
you can't,
yeah. There's no pain-free path. Let's put it that way.
Oh yeah. Yeah. But it depends also what you want to achieve. You know, obviously it's nice to see people on YouTube, like, you know, Benny, Richard, or some of the other people I mentioned earlier. It's nice to see people speaking 10, 15 languages. But I think for most people, adding one language is a huge achievement and you get a lot of enjoyment out of that process. But some people worry about how to learn 15 languages. Mm-hmm. And so they don't get started on the first one.
Right.
So, and it's kind of a shame because I think a lot of people have good reasons to do it. you know, some people love the culture of the country. Maybe they go there on holiday every year. There are people who retire abroad and don't really learn the language. There are people with grandparents that speak another language, or maybe they're in a, you know, in a really a cross-cultural relationship. So, you know, one side of the family has a different language to the other side. And there's just so many places where learning a little bit could really be beneficial. Mm-hmm. But because of the kind of the mountain in front of you, people tend to not even get started. And like I said, yeah, it's difficult to learn a language. It takes a long time to, you know, get close to natural conversation and really being able to watch native content and enjoy that. But right. Along the way, you get this enjoyment out of it. There's these checkpoints of, oh, I just said hi to that person in the language and they understood me. You know, oh, I just ordered in the restaurant. You know, that doesn't take many words.
Right. And you actually got what you ordered.
you actually got what you ordered. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a big accomplishment. Having
terrified of doing that.
Yeah. Had the opposite experience. Or getting on the right train or bus and ending up where you wanted to go instead of
buying a ticket, helping people. There are a lot of wins that happen with very limited vocabulary. And obviously a lot of the modern ways of learning languages are very centered around getting those wins early. So you learn a bit of crucial core vocabulary to what you need instead of 20 different species of animals that you're never going to see.
Right.
Yeah. So there's some pros and cons to both, but
yeah,
I think the important thing is just getting started. And, you know, if you don't like it, you shouldn't do it probably. That's the other thing.
Right. But I think to your point though, of breaking the journey into tiny little steps so that you can engineer in immediate consistent wins. That is so, so important. And I think a lot of people have this idea of, you know, like you said, it's this giant mountain you're going to climb. Like you can't climb a mountain. Just, you know,
no,
you
that's
can't.
It.
Yeah. You can take a step and then another step and then another step. But even that, it's pretty overwhelming. It's like, okay, I'm going to hike to this next little ridge and then I'll rest. Or, you know, I'm going to learn 10 kanji this week. That's winning, like rigging that game to win. So like you're engineering in consistent doses of dopamine to keep you going, I think is really what I've figured out is what most successful language learners do is they, whether consciously or unconsciously, they figure out a way to keep giving their brain little doses of feel good hormones that keeps them going and keeps them coming back. And, you know, maybe for you, like you said, learning English through video games, and it's like, that's a dopamine machine, right? They engineer those games to give you little puffs of, you know, of happy hormones along the way.
Yeah.
Coming back.
Absolutely. And it's the best way to learn language is doing it out of necessity for achieving something else.
Right.
So without English, I wasn't able to, you know, win the games or even figure out what the game was about. You know, try playing a football manager game or a soccer manager game and not knowing the language of the game. Like, what, you know, you have to, it would be boring as well, but it also be just impossible.
Yeah.
You know, how are you going to know what to focus on and send in the coach for, I don't know, the fitness coach to do, agility training. I don't know. but I think my English story is quite different from the other languages, and I've looked for ways to replicate it, but I'm not sure it can be done. I think you can get a lot of the way there. But I think it was just a combination of factors and also my age. I think when you're quite young, you're very kind of malleable in terms of activity and my brain obviously hyper focused on the task of learning English. Mm-hmm. I don't think you can force that. That's going to be very difficult, especially if you're a little bit older because, just less plasticity and maybe you're less focused as well. And you just, I think we tend to get bored as well. That's the thing I struggle with, where I can tell myself, okay, if I'm going to learn whatever, Hungarian, I'll find like a Hungarian gaming server. I'll only speak in that language. I'll only watch the native content. I'll read simple stories and I'll grow it that way. But the point is just, it's just not the same because I have a choice. You know, I know deep down that I can just stop anytime. Mm-hmm. I don't have to do this. And it doesn't change anything. So a lot of people ask me, like, how did you learn English that well? And it's just, I don't think my answer will help very much because it's such a unique situation. I don't know what you think about that.
Like, well, I think there's elements of it that are helpful. I mean, you like you said, you were motivated. You had a necessity for it. It wasn't a nice to have. It was like, you know, for your life, it was kind of a must have. So I think.
But how can you create that?
How can you replicate that? Yeah. Well, I think it's hard to maybe engineer necessity, but I think you can take some actions to create at least some kind of urgency. At least if you want to learn Japanese, for example, you can book a ticket to Japan in 6 months. You know, you can outlay that cash and say, okay, I've just spent $1,000 for this trip and I'm going to be throwing that money away if I go there and can't actually go to a sushi, you know, restaurant and order the sushi I want in Japanese. Like, so in a way I think you can engineer a little bit, but I agree. I understand that it's not maybe the same level of
necessity. And I don't think it will ever be again because it's such a unique situation because video games are the lingua franca of the internet and video games are just, it's English. So, and you know, for most people growing up today in the Western world, they will have a high level of English in most countries, as long as you have a fast internet connection.
Right.
I can't see people of today not learning at least conversational English or at least good enough to kind of get, you know, work in. But that's really hard to apply to other languages because the internet and games are so English, you know. There's no there are websites in other languages and there are games in other languages as well.
I think, but it just Chinese and Korean gaming scene's pretty big. So I think learning those two languages, there's definitely, you know, a lot of online gaming that's exclusively in those languages.
You also have slightly less English levels in general in that area of the world. So you might find the resources are more abundant in that in the local languages. Whereas a lot of other, let's say in Denmark, for instance, oftentimes I think they would almost default to English instead just to be more kind of internationally available. You know, companies it would be financially viable to do English because then everyone would understand it. But if you're in, let's say you're a Chinese company or event, then the audience is probably big enough there that you can just focus on that and have that as your language.
Right.
There are exceptions to every rule. That's also one of the things I've learned is that there's no right or wrong. You know, it's only trying and then you figure it out.
Yeah, no right or wrong. And there's, I think, one of the biggest things I've learned both in the language world, but also in the other world, I've spent a lot of my last 10 years, my career is in nutrition and realizing that there really is no one size fits all for anything, whether it's learning a language or it's figuring out, you know, what kind of foods work best for your body. It's all over the map and you have to do a lot of experimenting to figure out what works for you because what worked for Benny or Chris Broholm might not work for you. I think that it's a good place to start though. I love, you know, getting inspired by other polyglots or language learning and go, oh, they tried this method of two-way translations and watching a movie. It's like, oh, that's interesting. Let me try that and see if it works. You got to try something.
Keep it fresh. Yeah. Keep trying. Try everything. That's from Zootopia, but I think it's very applicable to all areas of life and especially language learning. You know, try everything. A great catchy tune as well, if you haven't heard it. So highly recommend it.
But watch it in your target language, not
your... Oh yeah, that's a really good tip actually, because I did that with the Frozen movie, which I thought was a great film, and I watched it in Hungarian and in Russian as well. And because I know you know the story already, and actually sometimes you can even remember the English lines.
Right.
You don't get as bored as if you're watching a native cartoon that you didn't understand or you didn't know what the story was at all. You know, for me that gets extremely boring. Even if I'm quite good at the language, if I'm not good enough to understand what's happening, I would just zone out after like 10 minutes. I don't know how many other people have that problem, but I think you need to be very high level in the language to put on, let's say, a native film or a native TV show that you don't know the story to. and then actually concentrate on that. That's why a lot of people use Harry Potter. That's why a lot of people use Friends. And like you brought up, like the cartoons, I think are great. Like I did it with Frozen and some of the other films, because you already know what's happening and you already know some of the lines. So it's much easier and it's good fun. And I think because of the music as well, it has natural like pauses and changes of pace. So you're not just watching a movie of an hour and a half in a foreign language. You're also getting, it's entertaining. Even if you don't understand the words, then it's still entertaining. I went to, when I was in Madrid a few years ago, we went to the local theater and we didn't really know what was on. It was like Cabaret, the musical. In Spanish. And we went up to the ticket office and went, could we have 3 tickets for the tonight's performance, please? And the guy was like, you guys know it's in Spanish, right? I mean, I couldn't replicate his accent, but he basically said that because we were obviously not Spanish speakers.
Yeah.
They're like, yeah, it's fine. I mean, it's going to be good fun. It's a musical, you know, it's enjoyable anyway. And so we go in and we have a great time. Absolutely fantastic. We had no idea what they were saying during the like normal dialogue portions, but because of the songs and dancing and kind of like the whole, you know how it is, you know, they put on context. All the stops. There's a lot of enjoyment there, and that's what I think the animated films, especially the ones with music in them, have going for them as well, which can really, and it all goes back to what we started saying about having fun and enjoying it. And if you don't, then you really need to find something else.
Yeah, I think with movies and this kind of media, it covers 2 essentials, which is it's fun, but it's also, to your point about understanding something or you zone out, you know, you need comprehensible input. You know, it's a big part of what Stephen Krashen talks about. You know, we only learn when we understand, but also we only have fun, I think, when we understand at least some of what's going on. If you had listened, I think, probably to that Cabaret and not been able to see it, I think probably you'd zone out too, right? You had to have a visual component to make it interesting and fun and at least somewhat comprehensible.
The comprehensible theory is quite interesting. I definitely agree that if you don't understand anything at all, it's going to be extremely boring and it's going to be extremely difficult. But there's a large gray area between, first of all, when do you understand something? Do you understand it when you understand every single word in the sentence?
Right.
Or do you understand it when you understand the gist of the sentence?
Right.
Or do you understand it when you actually just know the kind of the overall action of the, let's say you're watching a movie, you understand the kind of the plot.
Right.
But you have no idea what they're saying, but you understand what the whole plot was about. So that's a huge spectrum.
It is definitely a spectrum. Yeah. I think this is important to you know, clarify that I don't think his intent either was that it's perfect 100% comprehension. Because even native speakers, I mean, hope this isn't oversharing, hope she won't mind, but when my wife and I watch a movie, she often has a hard time understanding the plot, especially if it's a complex plot. So she will always go and read the entire movie description in IMDb. Plot spoilers and everything. Because for her, she will more enjoy the movie if she knows exactly what's happening throughout the entire movie. Whereas for me, I like the suspense of not knowing what's going to happen or even what's happening in the moment. I might not quite catch everything, but I like that. But obviously, you know, if we're watching a movie in English, I'm a native speaker. And there are definitely there are times when you don't necessarily know exactly what's happening. It's not 100% comprehension, but it's enough comprehension.
The specialized knowledge as well. Vocabulary. There's different levels of vocabulary. There's very simple kind of street vocabulary, and then you have very advanced academic, technological, niche, just some areas that you were like, I had no idea about this word. Luckily, with the movies, often you get the context and you learn the word that way, but I mean, native speakers are kind of given a free pass in that sense, and learners are put at an impossible standard. It's like if you make a mistake as a native speaker, it's like, you're native, whatever, do what you want. But if you're a learner, some cultures and some countries, it's very common to point it out, like you made a mistake kind of thing. Some people try to be helpful as well, but I think in general, people are quick to point out mistakes of L2 speakers, and if an L1 speaker makes a mistake, it's just whatever, you know, it's kind of glossed over.
Well,
and I think it might be similar with the comprehension or the,
A quick tangent on this though, too, is there are those that will try to point out quote unquote mistakes of native speakers too. But as a linguist, definitely a descriptive linguist, someone who thinks that the way people speak is quote unquote correct, I do get really annoyed when, oh, you made this mistake. You're not supposed to say that word. It's like, well, it's actually not a mistake. It's a dialectal difference.
Yeah.
And this idea that, I don't know if you've read or seen the new book, Because Internet, by Gretchen McCulloch. I had her on the show a couple weeks back, but you know, she has taken this awesome look at the way people are now speaking on the internet, because she's a linguist, and looking at, you know, these modern conventions and things of language usage, and kind of shining this sort of loving academic light on it, and showing that this fear that we're now devolving and that people don't know how to, you know, people don't read anymore. People don't know how to, they don't know how to write. They don't know how to speak. It's like, it's bollocks. It's bollocks.
Yeah,
it's actually,
absolutely.
There's a lot of really, there's a lot of cleverness. There's a lot of intelligence that goes into a lot of, you know, memes, and for example, or, you know, text conventions and things. So, yeah.
I think memes are beautiful. I think very few people appreciate that kind of, I mean, it's not, sometimes it's not even linguistic. It can be just like a picture, you know, there doesn't even need to be any text on it. But kind of the language of the memes, I'm a big fan of, because some of them, it's very high level thinking. It's very creative.
Yes. And there's a lot of layers to it. And there's a lot of, you know, assumed knowledge of what this is
based on
some other meme. It's like a meme of a meme of a meme. It starts to become like, oh, what was that movie? Where it's like a dream within a dream within a dream. Inception.
Yeah.
It's like Inception with memes these days. Yeah.
Because it's kind of like the hieroglyphs of the modern modern day, and it gets a bad rap. I think there are some things that are changing, but I think the problem is that some people consider it negative.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for instance, a lot of people are like, oh, nobody reads anymore. But it's like, no, nobody reads books anymore, maybe.
But I don't even know if that's true, though. I mean,
no, that books are more popular than ever.
Yeah, exactly. But
for
the data shows people read more now than ever, like in terms of words. If you add up all the words that a person will read in a given day, like
that's what I meant to say, is that because you get exposed to so much content online,
right?
The fact that I'm not reading, you know, Pride and Prejudice,
right?
You know, but I'm reading. And it's funny, you know, I've had Grammarly installed, you know, it's like a grammar checking software. And then, you know, most of the language, I'm pretty good at writing English. I will say I'm pretty good.
I will concur as a native speaker. I will give you thumbs up having read your copy.
But you know, obviously, and I'm also a little perfectionistic, but anyway, I decided to invest in Grammarly because there are still some mistakes that I do make, and it's easier for the program just to flash something in case I make a mistake.
Sure.
But what the fun thing they do is they send me like a weekly summary. And obviously I work in online media production, you know, actual fluency. I'll teach a language, which I'm part of as well. A lot of it is writing, whether it's email responses or, you know, writing actual campaigns, email campaigns or promotional materials, all that kind of stuff. And the amount of words that I write, not read, but write, is about, you know, sometimes it could be as much as 50,000 words a week.
Right, which is and a it's novel. Like,
exactly.
You're writing a novel a week.
So it's like, you can criticize me for saying, Chris, you haven't read a book in years, and you'd be pretty much right. I mean, I read a few nonfiction books here and there, but like, actually reading a nonfiction book. I can't remember the last time I did that. That was probably Harry Potter, like 5-10 years ago or something. It just doesn't interest me. But, you know, it's easy to criticize someone without knowing the full story. And I think with the young people today, it's exactly the same. All they do is they're online, they're consuming content. And just because they kind of moved over from one medium to the other doesn't mean that it's a bad thing.
Right. Yeah, there's an arrogance around forms of media. I always find it interesting that for whatever reason, if you are consuming a book through your eyeballs, that's somehow supposed to be superior to absorbing it through your ears. You know, like an audiobook versus a print. Like, why? Why does it matter how the signals are being encoded in your brain? As long as you're learning something and then applying it in your life, it doesn't matter how it gets into your head. Yeah.
And we see it with language learning, how technology really helps speed up the process. Mm-hmm. You know, you can do flashcards, actual flashcards, like
physical,
you can print out.
Right.
Oh yeah. Or you can buy a flashcard set and write yourself with it, mm-hmm. with a pen and paper.
Right.
And some people would say that that's better. Or you could just do like 95% of people are doing anyway, go online, find a flashcard software, mm-hmm. and it will do all the magic for you.
Right.
And it's the time you save, it's just monumental. It's like the difference between, I don't know, filling a Olympic sized swimming pool with a cup rather than using the actual hose, you know?
Right. but this gets into something though I'm struggling with myself, of trying to figure out what actually makes more sense and what is more effective, because there is an argument to be made that creating them by hand in and of itself helps with retention and helps your brain have more hooks to hold on to the information, because you created it yourself with your hands and all these different, you know, the tactile element, the, you know, you have the smell of the paper. Like there's so many more channels of input that it can actually create a more powerful form of immersion, but it does take a lot of time. And then on the other hand, you know, with the spaced repetition apps, you know, it's like, to your point, it's automatically scheduling things in just the right, maybe not just the right, but a better, more ideal schedule where you're not wasting time reviewing something that you already know. You're only focusing on what you are about to forget or already forgot. So I don't know. I'm stuck between these two things, where on the one hand you have the efficiency of doing things faster, but on the other hand you have the efficacy of doing things in a little bit slower, more laborious way. So
yeah, I've had this particular kind of I've had this thought before, that there are times where efficiency is not ideal. I think with flashcards, it's too big of a difference to even consider, because by the time you've considered what words to use, written all the flashcards by hand, and gone through it once, I would have already gone through 5,000 words or something.
Mm-hmm.
Not that that should be a goal for anyone, to learn 5,000 words as fast as possible.
Right.
But
especially if they're out of context, because that's
right. Yeah,
that's my beef with a lot of flashcards. It's like, oh, you have your target language word on one side, and then you have the translation on the other side. It's like, okay.
Yeah.
Almost useless. Because you don't go around your life, you know, if you go to Japan, someone's not going to show you a single word in isolation, and then they're going to quiz you on what it means. You know, that's not how languages work.
I think flashcards in general will always be, and should always be, in my opinion, this is just some people might disagree, but I think they should always be a complement to other things you're doing. Like, no matter how intricate or complicated your flashcards are, they'll always, quote unquote, just be flashcards.
Right.
You know, it's just a way to learn and store something.
You can't have a conversation with a flashcard.
No,
it's not yet. A magic.
No, not yet. But you could put whole sentences on the flashcards,
right.
And then
I recommend. And if you can add audio to them as well, that's great.
You can do a bunch of things.
Photos,
to do it, and in that sense, it's better.
Yeah.
But I think the most important metric for any language learning method is whether you enjoy it or not. Because if you can't stand doing flashcards, it doesn't matter that I'm saying that going on, you know, Anki or whatever, feels like downloading a language to my brain,
mm-hmm.
if you can't stand doing 5 minutes of it.
Right.
So instead of discussing kind of what's most efficient and what's not, and this is a silly thing, but I named it after myself, you know, very humble person here. I call it like the Broholm coefficient, is that the best method for you to use is the one that is the most fun and the most efficient. So it's like, if you imagine like graph, there'll be methods that are extremely boring but very efficient,
mm-hmm.
and there'll be methods that are extremely fun but very inefficient. Like watching a movie, for instance, is usually quite enjoyable,
right.
but the language learning aspect of it is quite I mean, let's say speculative at best. You know, I'm sure you can learn a lot from movies, especially with subtitles, and if you do like focused watching. But for me, like, you know, wouldn't get much out of it. Most people won't. But it's a lot of fun, so you can do it all the time. So I think the key for any language learner is to find the sweet spot of enjoyment and efficiency. And oftentimes, the most efficient ways are very boring. Like just doing flashcards, fill in the blanks, unless you're some kind of, I don't know, unless that's your thing, you'll be quite bored of that after a while, especially if you have thousands of them.
Yes.
So if you like the idea, sitting down with a box of flashcards, paper on cardboard or whatever, and drawing some beautiful images and having a nice learning system instead of just doing word on one side in English, word on the other side in the target language, the learning process is going to teach you a lot in and of itself, and then you can use the cards afterwards. If that's what you really enjoy, then I think you should do it. Mm-hmm. But for most people, I think oftentimes the technological version is going to be so much simpler, so much easier to keep track of, that there's really no comparison. Like I said before, by the time you've created 100 flashcards, I think I would have gone to 1,000 maybe online.
Right.
If we're just talking, it's of course, you know, you can make your own flashcards online as well. That's kind of like a middle ground, you know.
Yeah, and probably a good one because, have you interviewed Gabriel Weiner?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's been on.
Yeah, great. So, yeah, in his, you know, in his book, Fluent Forever, and then in his new app, like a big part of his approach is making your own flashcards. Because his whole point is if you're just getting a pre-made deck online, there's no context. There's no, you know, relevance in your life. I would still argue there's still some value in that, to your point. They're already made. And so you can just get going with them. You don't have to spend the time, but
yeah, the early vocabulary is going to be generally the same for most people. Like we all need to say where we're from, what our names are, what we do, you know, where we live, all these basic things, how we feel. So it makes sense that the first, let's say 500 words are the same, you know, because you have to, the key difference, I think, is you need to fill in the blanks with your profile.
Yeah.
So you need
your life experience. Like it,
yeah, exactly. If I'm an ambulance driver, it would be very beneficial for me to know that word. If I'm not, then it absolutely doesn't matter at all.
Right.
Then I could never learn that word and I'd be absolutely fine. I would just say the guy who drives the ambulance.
Right.
But if that's your job, then, you know, you probably should know the word for it.
Right. Know? Yeah, so, and car so accident and heart attack and like that.
There you go. Exactly.
That vocab that's for that. You is part of your. It should be part of your first 1,000 words. But for me,
and this is one of the big tips, isn't it? From that I've got from interviewing language learners is context.
Yes,
context matters a lot, and just learning what the textbook tells you to learn really doesn't help you very much.
Right.
So spending some time writing out your script, like you know, when you meet someone you've never met before. The questions are usually all the same.
Right.
So have those ready and then you can add on a little bit every time. Or if somebody asks you a question, you're like, I wonder how to say that. And then you do it later. Mm-hmm. If they ask you like, where were you born? For instance, oh, I forgot that one. Mm-hmm. You know, and then you go back and kind of amend your vocabulary later.
Right.
But beginning, you need to know the basics, like the pronouns, the articles, the sort of first few hundred words. So that says I don't mind that those are generic, as long as you add whatever you need on top.
Right.
But as you progress, the value of kind of personalizing your learning and also I think it makes it more fun. Like if you really like dinosaurs. Then reading about dinosaurs in your target language is going to be a lot better than reading about, I don't know, knitting recipes or something. Unless you like that, of course.
Unless you love knitting. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, there you go. Exactly. There's something for everyone.
Right.
But a lot of people make the mistake that they let the textbook decide what topic to talk about.
Exactly. You know, which are always the same usually generic things that are... They think
checking into hotel.
Yeah, they think these are useful topics. And maybe they are for a lot of people. But I think the other thing there that came up in my mind is this idea of learning lots of just in case vocabulary instead of what I think makes more sense is the just in time approach, going back to Toyota. Somehow we brought up Toyota three times in this interview. They're not sponsoring these podcasts, we promise.
They really should. I need a car.
My brother used to work for them. Maybe I can get an inside track.
Yeah. I'm sure they would sponsor a small-time podcast with a car.
Yeah, because that makes sense. Yeah, we're talking about languages. Yeah. No, but they are famous for this idea of just-in-time JIT manufacturing, where instead of having a whole bunch of surplus parts sitting in a factory, they only will bring into the factory the parts they need today or tomorrow.
Yeah.
And I think vocabulary is a really similar thing, where instead of going and memorizing a whole bunch of stuff you might use someday, it's like, okay, I'm going to go buy a cell phone today in Taiwan or whatever. I'm going to learn the vocabulary I'm going to need to buy a cell phone today or tomorrow, whatever it is. And I think that creates that urgency too, and having that why. You know you're going to need this right away. And so I think your brain at a subconscious level will hold on to that information more. Because there is
to what we started saying, that if you can have those wins, if you can go and use the language, you get more motivation and enjoyment, and you get that dopamine spike that we talked about.
Right.
Or what's the other one? Whatever. Good drug spike.
Serotonin.
And, serotonin, that's the one. And you do that by kind of... It's a bit, you're faking it in a sense. It's a bit like fake it till you make it, because you're essentially deconstructing conversation. And let's say you go to some meetup, and you've learned your kind of script that people normally ask to a T. Like, you can understand every question and you can give all the answers, but if they ask you anything else, you don't know anything. But just the activity of getting that success really motivates you to push on. Compare that with the traditional way of learning, like in school, where all they do is teach you grammar rules and words, where you kind of have to build up an entire language from the ground up. Mm-hmm. It's like night and day, you know? So I think that's also one of the biggest kind of aha moments I had, is that learning a language is a bit like a giant jigsaw puzzle. You know, some people think that language learning is very linear, that you start at point A, and then you get to point whatever the last letter in your alphabet is. I guess is it Z?
Z or Z, depending on who you ask. Yeah.
Z or Z. Yeah. Well, my language has a few more letters, so we end in a different letter. But anyway,
is that right?
Danish. The Danish letters go at the end. Yeah. Oh. So we have A, U, O at the end.
Interesting.
But anyway, the point
I had just trying explode. To make, I didn't know that. Okay.
There you go. I mean, cool. You have that new next time you're in a pub quiz and they ask you what does Danish alphabet end in, you know it. Yeah. No, but I think that's one thing I've learned, is that it's not a linear experience to learn a language. Right. Basically, you have this giant jigsaw puzzle. And if you've seen, I wouldn't call them professional jigsaw puzzlers, but if you've seen, like, you know how it is, like 50,000 pieces of a cloud.
Right.
You know,
right.
They all look the same. Yeah. Like, honestly, it's like, how can you even do that? But anyway, that takes probably years. I don't know. I've never done that. But what you do is you essentially take piece by piece and you insert them wherever you can kind of find where the piece goes. So learning that one phrase, learning that one word that you need for your job or whatever, you're essentially building up your jigsaw puzzle, which is the foreign language that you want to learn, or the target language. And then eventually the connections start appearing. And this is kind of scary in a way sometimes, because your brain is really much more powerful than you can imagine. So I remember for Russian, for instance, I was doing a lot of different things, experimenting with a lot of different methods. But I did a lot of flashcards, and I never really got the flashcards to convert into sentences. But then suddenly my level was good enough where I suddenly started to see the pattern. And then all the flashcard knowledge came back. And I was like, how do I remember this word? I saw this once a year ago on a flashcard, but my brain somehow retained that information. And that's connecting the pieces slowly and slowly. And then eventually, theoretically, I suppose, you will have your picture, your end jigsaw puzzle that you can frame. But arguably, you never really finish. Because even native speakers have lots of holes.
Correct. Like, yeah, there's no end. Like we were talking about earlier, there really is no end point for any language, even your native language. Yeah. I learn new words in English every day.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, do you know what inanition means?
I do not. Do you know?
There you go. I mean, there's just an example. And there are like, what, 100,000 words in English or something? Most people use about 2,000 every week.
Yeah.
And that's, and I got this from Grammarly as well, actually. It tells me how many unique words I use. And I think I was about 2,000. And it gave me like a little badge and said, you're using more unique words than 99% of our users.
Wow.
So it's really not a lot of words, but they exist.
Right.
And every time I hear a word, and this is why I love English, by the way. I'm sure other languages are similar, but I feel like English is a language that has so many words that mean exactly what you want to say.
Right.
You know, yeah, there's like a common word that everyone knows that kind of explains it, but then there's this like, that's the word. That's exactly. You know, for instance, the biggest example I can give is the word imperative, which is not that advanced. You know, people do use it. But if I say, oh, it's necessary that you do this, you like totally understand it. It makes sense. But if I say it's imperative that you do it,
it's more punch.
It's like that meaning is so spot on. It's crazy. That's like a million examples of English, of course. But
what I love in English, kind of a similar note, is that we often have synonyms where one of them comes from Germanic and one like Anglo-Saxon, you know, background, then one comes from French, and the French origin word usually sounds more formal or hoity-toity, you know, sounds like kind of high class, and then the Anglo-Saxon one sounds more kind of earthy and visceral and kind of low brow, right? Right? Like sweat versus perspire means the same thing.
There you go,
but there's a totally different connotation to those words. And there's all sorts of those pairs. I think it's really interesting.
But it's a shame also that learning these words won't really do you much good, because if the people you speak to don't understand them, then it doesn't matter. I mean, sweat and perspiration, I think everyone would know those, but you know, if you have a really great word to explain something and you can't say it, that's actually really annoying, because you just know they're not going to understand it.
Yeah, but, or if they don't know the word. This is something that happens a lot. I think a lot of foreign languages is you want to know how to say X in that language. And so you go to the dictionary and you look up that word. And if that dictionary doesn't include whether that word is common or uncommon, you might learn a really uncommon. This happens in Japanese actually a lot.
There'll
be a really uncommon word, and you'll say it, and people, you maybe even pronounce it perfectly. But if they don't actually know that word, and because they assume you're a foreigner, you're not going to use an uncommon term. They're going to think you only know basic words, and so often you'll be met with confusion. Which, just a little plug for an app. Anyone who's learning Japanese, there's a great new dictionary app called Nihongo, which is just Japanese in Japanese. by developers, I think it's Chris Vaselli, if I'm pronouncing that right. But he includes in the dictionary whether it's common, uncommon, or rare next to every word. And it's great, because then you'll look up a word and realize like, oh, this is rare. So probably it's not worth my time right now, starting out, putting too much effort into this word.
But that's, again, why context matters, because you can learn words that are archaic as well.
Right.
Russian has this a lot, where you usually have multiple words, but if you learn an old word, what they might say is something like, oh, nobody says that anymore, or you sound like an old woman when you say that, you know. and it's funny, but the only way you can really know is if you learn in context. And that's, again, the power of not using like single word flashcards.
Yes.
You have that, and again, it's also watching, I would say, contemporary TV shows or movies, getting the language from there instead of, I mean, some textbooks might be reprinted over and over. So they might've been written in the 1950s, but the dialogue hasn't been updated since they were published.
Yeah.
So people speak in kind of a funny way. And a lot of languages have had major kind of overhauls in the last 100 years, which is really not that long for languages, but
they change fast. Every generation adds their little like bits of flair and
small changes and big changes. Like there's been grammar, what do you call it? Like there's been massive grammar changes in Russian, German, and Danish in the last 50 years. So they basically, as a policy, decided to change. For instance, in Danish, they used to capitalize all the nouns like they still do in German.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay.
They used to do that. Yeah. In Danish, they got rid of the double A. So all words that began with a double A or had double A in it somewhere, they got their own letter. So that's how the A with the kind of circle on top of it became. Okay. So that they got rid of that. They don't use the double A anymore. Russian had spelling reforms as well. Mm-hmm. Some letters were made obsolete, and they removed as well. So it's really necessary to use. Well, it's funny. I just got an email from Grammarly. It just popped up on my watch. Says, "Wow, that's one big vocabulary." That's funny. That's just what we're talking about.
Oh. And to be clear, Grammarly is not sponsoring this podcast either, or are they? Not mine. Okay.
But they should. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, they say I use 4,000 unique words this week, but it changes, you know, depending on what you talk about.
I want to go back to that because the thought came to me too that while we're talking about how many words there are and how much, you know, nuance and subtlety you can express, but I also want to be very clear to those that are starting out in a language that you don't need that many words to communicate almost anything you want to say. And my favorite example of this is Dr. Seuss. You know, I don't know if this is apocryphal or if it's true, but apparently him and another author had bets about, you know, they said, I think it was 500 words. Like I dare you to write a book with only 500 words. And then he did it.
Yeah.
And then he did it again with only 100 words. And that's, Green Eggs and Ham, I think, is only 100 words in that. I hope I'm getting that right. But the point being that you can do a lot with a little, and that's one of the themes I've noticed, at least with polyglots, is I think one of the things that they're really good at, though they're just normal people, they're just doing the work. But there is one thing I've noticed as a trend that they're really creative with a little. Like they can take 100 words in their new language and they can do a lot more with it than I think maybe a new inexperienced language learner could do with that same 100 words. Is that something you've also noticed?
Yeah, definitely. And I think, again, it comes back to the context and the strategic learning in the beginning, where you don't learn 20 words for 20 different verbs. You learn the few top verbs that you want to use with some nouns and conjugations that you will use. But I think a real mark of language skill is and what I would probably call fluency is where you can sort of explain your way out of what you're trying to say.
Right.
You know, where you might not know the word or the exact words or phrases to use, but you can say something like, if in English it would sound something like, "Oh yeah, I went to the store and then I used this, you know, the thing they have in the end you used to buy all your stuff, and then I went to the place where all the cars are parked, mm-hmm. and then we went on the big road with that are separated in the middle." You know,
right. you talk your way around the words you don't
know. Yeah, I don't know if I don't know the words for register or car park or highway.
Right.
I can explain what I'm trying to say. Whereas once you're in the beginner stages of the language, that is quite tricky, but you can kind of hack that by learning that first.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't remember who came up with this originally, but Benny Lewis was talking about something called connectors or sentence connectors, mm-hmm. where a lot of sounding fluent is really just a lot of filler words.
Right. Well, it keeps you flowing. Know? And I think that's technically, I think what fluency really means is it's a flow.
Yeah,
you can just keep, even if you're having to stop a little bit and you struggle with some words, as long as you just keep that flow going. It's the problem early on is when it's just like crickets, you know, you're trying to like, and that makes both sides really nervous. And so to your point, if you can learn some of these filler words and words that you can use to signal to the other person, the interlocutor, as it were, that you're thinking, and that you're not panicking or that you're kind of, you know, like in Japanese, there's the great, you know, ano. It's just, it means like, technically means that, but you say that when you're kind of, it'd be like, in English, you know, you're like, or, you know, those kind of words. Yeah. They're super powerful.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And if you observe native speakers in any language, they have these ways of basically saying nothing. They're basically saying nothing. Yeah.
Well, that was the entire show of Seinfeld. You know, it was
just say was nothing.
Seven seasons about nothing.
Say nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, here even the sentences don't have meaning. But of course, when we speak, I think also the problem some people have is they put too much pressure on themselves. Mm. So when we're speaking now in sort of a, let's say, the highest level of fluency possible, we're speaking in a way that entertains the ears, and we're kind of making it pleasurable to talk to each other. Mm-hmm. So we're doing the, you know, up and down as English has with the rhythm of the language, but also the pauses and the words and the, you know, emphasis and that kind of stuff. We're trying to basically make the other person interested in what we're saying without being boring or tedious or monotone. And when you're a new language learner, sometimes it feels like you have to perform from day one. Mm. And that's a big pressure to put on yourself. So, and that's not just pronunciation. That's also things like using full sentences.
Right.
I think, you know, something that I learned from studying Tokipona, which is a language with only 120 to 30 words, depending on what word list you use, is to really... language is just a translation of our thoughts. Mm-hmm. So when I'm speaking now, I'm trying to convey what my extremely complex and, you know, nobody really knows how the brain works. They say something about electric currents and stuff, but nobody really knows anything. So basically what it's doing is I'm translating what I'm thinking. It's right. Like something... it's not a tangible thought. It's like a principle or a concept into
an image or yeah.
Yeah. Or yeah, exactly.
Yeah, we don't actually think emotion. In words. A lot of people think think in words,
well,
but we don't.
Some people do. There is some kind of
really?
Yeah, there's some kind of a like mental either disorder or whatever you call it, like syndrome where you either cannot imagine anything or you actually do think that way. But most of us, would be. And I guess it sometimes all depends what language you're using. If you're using your native language, you're more likely to use your thoughts. But if you, let's say you're speaking in a weak L2, sometimes we might try to be interpreters instead.
Right.
So we're taking our inner voice and translating it.
Well, and that's why it's so slow for so many language learners.
Yeah.
They think because of not to, you know, poop on schools and traditional learning too much, but it's one of my hobbies, so I'll do it. But I think that's one of the big mistakes people make is they think the way to learn the language is to translate. And that's why they're so darn slow and it takes them so long to reach fluency is they're having to go through so many stages in their brain to get from what they want to say to actually the, you know, arbitrary vibrations of their vocal cords to communicate that thing. So
yeah, and that was exactly the point that I was making is that a language, it's very rare that languages can be translated one-to-one anyway. Mm-hmm. So you're already at a disadvantage by translating because that's not how your brain works. You know, you don't think in words, you think in concepts and thoughts and emotions. So you're already translating it into one language, but then you're saying this sentence that I have thought up in my head in English,
right,
I'm going to try and say it in Russian, which is completely different, or in Japanese. Let's try that.
Yeah.
If I had to say the sentence I was thinking in English in Japanese, I would just fall flat because I'd be like, I have no idea how to do that. But instead, and this is what Tokipona taught me, and I actually do recommend it, people learning it, not for communication because that's very difficult, as you can imagine, when you only have 120 words. Actually, it's not hard to speak. It's just hard to understand because you have to learn what the person is. Basically, you have some kind of shared vocabulary. So, for instance, there's some standard between speakers. There'll be a standardization. But for instance, if you want to say car, there's no word for car. So what you can say is something like moving building.
Oh, okay.
But if you went up to me and said moving building, I have no idea if you're talking about a train or a plane or a car or a RV, a camper van. Uh-huh. I mean, whatever. It could be literally a moving building. I guess you can move buildings. So that's why I don't really recommend it as a sort of communication tool, but as a philosophical.
It wouldn't be a good lingua franca, definitely not.
No, it'd be very difficult. But and also there's a lot of subjectivity. So for instance, might call coffee a good liquid. But if somebody doesn't like coffee, they would think of that. But anyway, that was a side note, but I wouldn't learn it for the speaking. But what they did teach me is that as a new language learner, your aim should not be to be one-on-one with your stronger languages in terms of translation. What you should try to do is convey the meaning, not the phrase or the words in entirety. So let's say you want to say something like, could you tell me where the post office is?
Right.
You know, that's a very formal, that's a very long sentence. Nobody says that anyway. So why are you expecting to say that in Spanish or Italian or whatever language you're learning? What is it that you're really trying to say?
Yeah.
You're basically saying where post office.
Right.
So that whole sentence could be cut down to three words.
Right.
It's not the most polite thing just to go up to someone on the street and say, where post office?
Yeah.
But you've just enabled communication.
Right. Well,
that wasn't there before.
It depends on the culture. And this is why, again, context is so important because, like, well, with Japanese again.
Oh, yeah. That would be how you said
it.
Yeah. That would be exactly how you said it.
Right. Well, in China, you would say that and it'd be just fine. But if you're just to say that, you know, the equivalent of those words in Japanese, it would be a little bit rude. You know, there's a lot more formality and stuff that goes into that culture.
Of course.
But
being rude is not.
Understood is more important than being.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to say. Especially if you're trying to look for a hospital. I mean, post office, you might be okay being polite, but if it's a hospital, you don't care if you're being rude or not. If you have a knife sticking out your back or something, you
know, you're a paramedic driver.
Where's the hospital? Yeah. You know, you don't even care. Where hospital?
Yeah.
So that's a big lesson for me that what was holding me back in Russian early on was. Essentially, I was trying to be too clever. I was trying to sound more advanced than I really was. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to translate from English into Russian, sort of replacing each word of the sentence.
Yeah.
And it just doesn't work because they're so different. You could probably do that with like maybe French and English especially languages that are really close. You can do it with more success.
Right.
But I would still recommend people to, instead of say what you're saying, say what you're thinking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in your new language anyway.
Right.
And then you find that you take away a lot of the kind of restrictions and barriers because the grammar is much more simple that way. It's like Tarzan language, you know?
Right.
And that can really help getting those wins early on.
And again, to go back to the importance of getting your input from authentic sources, then you're actually going to see what a native speaker would say in any given situation. But then I think with that too, a good supplement is, you know, we talked earlier about having tutors. That's such an important part of, I think, shortening your language learning journey is just, you can just ask a native speaker, hey, what would you say in this situation? Instead of, trying to figure out and parsing out how to translate what you want to say. You just ask them directly and they say, yeah, we say this. You're like, oh, cool. Okay. That just saved me 5 hours.
That's a really good question to ask, and especially if you have a starting point of some ideas. The way you thought it was supposed to be said, then you can ask a tutor, "How would you say?" And then you can give the English sentence because then they will say what they say and not translate. You know, that's a very different question than saying, can you translate this, please? Right. Which some people will say.
Yeah.
Some people, when they're with a tutor or a teacher, they'll say, oh, can you just translate this English sentence into Russian for me?
Mm.
And it's like, no, that's a bad question. It's better to say, how would you say
How would you say, exactly.
Yeah, because I remember as a teacher, it was very often the case that a lot of the sentences that people were saying were unnatural.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say, you know, this is technically correct, but nobody would say that.
Right.
So.
Well, and this is one of the reasons why in the translation world, you know, one of the kind of unspoken rules is that you're not supposed to translate into the foreign language. You're, as a rule, you're only usually supposed to translate into your native language as a translator.
Right.
But when I was in Japan.
Because you're not. You're not translating, really.
Right.
Sorry, to interrupt. You're not translating. You're not translating words and phrases. You're translating meaning.
Meaning, exactly. You know, one of the quick tangent off a tangent, but Mike Campbell, I know we've both had on our podcasts. you know, one of the things he's really working on doing with Glossika, his language learning platform, is what he calls deep semantics. So instead of trying to translate one language to the next, he's trying to figure out what is the actual deep meaning behind any given phrase, and then localizing that meaning into each of the languages they offer, which I don't know how they're doing it, but it sounds, you know, really complex and delightfully nerdy. But so far, it seems like they're doing a pretty good job with it. But anyway, well,
that's the big weakness of apps and software that do it that way. And it's really difficult. I did some work on the Danish word list for Glossika.
Oh, you did? Okay. So you actually know probably kind of how the sausage is made a little bit more.
Yeah. And the problem was that the method of Glossika uses a, I forgot where it comes from, but it's basically, they have a lot of different sentence structures. Like, here is the ball. I give the ball to you. So for languages that have, let's say, dative cases, like objects, direct and indirect objects, there would be different endings for that. But in English, obviously, it's all the same, so it doesn't really matter. But
well, it is now. If you go back a few hundred years, then we used to have much more complexity. Yeah.
Thou and thy.
Yeah.
But the problem is that sometimes that meant that the English sentence would be translated to the same, two different English sentences would have the same translation in Danish, which doesn't make a lot of sense if you're doing like a learning, learning platform. It doesn't make sense to have the same, but it, things like in English, you say, would, could, can, will, I'm going to, for instance, I'll go to the theater tomorrow. Mm-hmm. I am going to the theater tomorrow. Some languages probably is the same.
Right.
So that is really the limitation. And I think a big criticism of a lot of these massive apps, I think Duolingo actually does a remarkable job with this. They don't have this problem for some reason.
Well, they have a massive team and a lot of money. I think that's part of it.
Yeah. Well, the courses are created by volunteers, but they don't build the new course starting with a copy from the old course.
Right.
So it's basically like it's a whole new thing. Yeah. But if you go to some apps like, what's the big one that everyone's talking about? Babbel. Babbel is everywhere.
Yeah.
Like if you go in anywhere, you'll see ads for Babbel, like Facebook ads. I even saw it in an in-flight magazine once. They had an ad for Babbel, and it's a big venture-backed, and they have a million languages.
Yeah.
Like they might not be as bad as some other platforms, but basically what they're guilty of is just translating.
Yeah.
And it's bad for so many reasons, but the linguistics is almost like the least of your worries. Like being grammatically correct is probably not that bad, but the problem is, you know, there's a kind of a convention of how you say things, of what you say and when you say it. And
what you talk about. I mean,
exactly.
The topics that you're going to talk about in like Japanese are going to be very different than what you're going to talk about in Spanish, for example.
Yeah, like cat cafes and all that kind of stuff.
Exactly.
That's not going to be very relevant in many places.
Yeah.
No, I know. Actually, they do have cat cafes in Europe now, which is very strange. Very strange. I went to one once, and it's like, yeah, it's not something that I'm. I don't know. I haven't gotten a
sponsor.
I don't know how big that is in Japan. Yeah. Obviously, that's a big. What do you call it? Very stereotypical. I don't know if they have them everywhere in Japan, but.
They didn't really have them when I was there, but I was there a long time ago. So, yeah, like 2003, 2005.
Oh, yeah?
Which is crazy to think it's been that long.
I know they have they do have them there for sure. I've seen some of it. But I also saw that they had there was a wood somewhere with foxes in it or something. You can come up and pet a fox, or it's like a deer wood. You come up and you feed them some deer food. I don't know what deers eat, but and you could pet them. And it seems like
in Nara, there's these basically trained deer that you come up, give them food, and they will bow first.
Oh, right.
You give them the food. But pro tip. Do not keep the food in your pocket because they will bite through your pocket to get at it. So,
right. Yeah, but that, to me, that's like the most Japanese thing ever.
Yeah.
Like having a sort of cutish animal bow to you together,
yeah,
a biscuit or whatever, is, it's kind of funny.
Yeah, it's very meta. But yeah, I think the thing about having a small set of words that you know how to use really well, I think that's definitely something that I didn't do when I first started out that I'm now trying to do more of when I start a new language, is just, you know, give me the highest frequency stuff and I'm going to learn it upwards, downwards, backwards and forwards, you know, because
yeah,
well, it's the same thing I learned in martial arts. When you first start out in a martial art, you know, you watch a kung fu movie or something and you want to, it's like, oh, it's so cool, I want to learn all these flashy movements. But what you realize over time is you just need to know a few movements really, really well and be able to apply yeah. them in any situation. There's that great Bruce Lee quote, I don't fear the man who's practiced 10,000 kicks once. I fear the man who's practiced one kick 10,000 times.
Yeah. Well, I would fear both because I'm used as a martial arts, but
the
sentiment is absolutely correct.
Yeah.
And in language learning, finding that efficiency, enjoyment, and like the balance of all things, that's also a very kind of Asian philosophy. I feel like the balance of all things is tricky, is really difficult because there's a big tendency to overshoot it very often. Like, okay, I'm really bored by my textbook. I'm going to watch Friends in Spanish all day. It's like, yeah, that will help you some, but like the real progress in language learning is really when you do active learning.
Right.
Like, you know, passive learning is great and it really helps, but the big leverage is active learning.
Right.
And I think a lot of people, yeah, they kind of go too far one way. And yeah. I also struggle with this a lot. It's like, how do you balance all things, all the, right. you know, because we've said a lot of things already. If you kind of distilled what we've said into advice, then it's basically, is overwhelming in a way because it makes it sound like, oh, you have to do all these things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's something I haven't quite figured out how to convey that, because my philosophy, if anything, is that every little bit helps,
mm-hmm.
and you will figure out what you like by doing it a little bit at a time. You shouldn't get burned out or anything by planning to do a million things at once. But at the same time, I also want to share some of the tips that definitely helped me and others.
Right.
You know, but I don't want to overwhelm people as well, but it's a fine balance.
It's a delicate
balance.
Yeah. I mean, one could say that really all you have to do to learn language is show up and get enough exposure and then practice. Everything else is details. But most of the interesting stuff and most of the optimization happens in the details. And so it's that balance.
Yeah. But the problem is, I think we often get lost in the details. Like it's like Jim Rohn said, people major in minor things.
Yeah.
And I think for language learning, that's exactly what people do. And it goes back to what we talked about, information overload. So yeah. if I had to give just one tip, I think if I was like pressed, it'd probably be just do something.
Yeah.
Just do something.
Right.
Don't worry about what it is or how you're doing it. Just do it. And once that thing you're doing becomes painful or no longer enjoyable,
yeah.
Do something else.
Do something, right. This concludes part one of my chat with Chris Broholm from the Actual Fluency Podcast. Tune in next week to get part two. And make sure to check out the show notes at languagemastery.com/show. All right, we'll see you next Mastery Monday.